This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
And this is Doug Pollard. This hour is our usual Digging Deeper segment, when we spend an hour with someone special to find out a little bit about their life and work. And the person we're talking to today is a gentleman called Simon Blake. And his first choice of music was Beyoncé, If I Were a Boy. Simon, why did you choose that piece of music?
I first saw Beyoncé perform that on X Factor, which is a pop talent show
in
the UK.
We have it here too.
And it just made me tingle. You know, I watched her perform and I thought, well, this woman is pretty cool. I wish I could dance like that. ever since that time, it's been one of those songs that if you're getting ready to go out on a long car journey, often will be singing, screaming, shouting, however you describe what my voice is. And it just is great. The other side of it is, of course, that also gender is a really important issue.
Indeed.
Throughout all of my life, my working life, addressing relationships, what men and women want from each other and how, whether they're gay or straight, is just absolutely fundamental.
And that's a very good summation in many respects of like the traditional dynamic between boy, girl, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is. And of course, actually, though, what we really know is that it's often a typical summation of what relationships are like, that we're not necessarily as kind as we could be to each other when we're going out. And maybe we've got to just help all of us get a bit better in relationships.
Amen to that. Amen to that. Now, you're currently the chief executive of Brooke, which is the UK's sexual health charity for young people under the age of 25, whose mission, and I quote here from the brief bio I got, to enable young people to enjoy their sexuality without harm. Now, we'll talk about your job, what you're doing now, a bit later on. But I wanted to go right back to the beginning and find out where you came from. Where were you born?
I was born in Plymouth, which is Devon, on mm-hmm. the southwest peninsula in England, and then moved across the border into Cornwall. So pretty much at the end of our little island.
So West Country. Plymouth is a naval town, isn't it?
It is.
Because I remember one time there were lots of naval cuts in the UK and Julian Clary came on and said the streets of Plymouth would be running with discharged seamen with his typical humour. What sort of a family did you have? Are you an only child, one of many siblings?
I have one older brother, 4 years older, and mum and dad. And we grew up in a small town called Camelford. Lots of ways, very ideal, lots of freedom, fields behind the house, could run around, do what we wanted, argue, shout, scream as families do, but essentially loving each other.
So it was a good childhood?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't want to live in the country now full time, but as a child growing up, being able to do what you wanted, when you wanted and how you wanted to, it was just bliss.
So what did your parents do for a living?
My mum makes jewellery, enamel jewellery, and mm-hmm. my dad worked at the local factory, which is a cheese factory. And they worked, mum worked away a lot and dad did an awful lot helping her, and so it was a real sense of friends helping each other look after children while parents went out to work and made things work however they could.
So obviously things worked out pretty well for you as a child. What was school like?
School for me was three things really. Primary school was really good fun. All of us would...
I think it is for nearly well everybody, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think so. But I think it's important just to clock that that it was a great place. And I think the reason it was a great place was because there were teachers who knew you, who looked out for you. And what I found when we went to secondary school was that suddenly things were a bit bigger, that you had mixes of age groups and... as often happens in adolescence, I think people got cruel from time to time. Essentially, it was a good time at school, but overall, Were they the happiest days of my life? Probably not. It wasn't as stimulating as it might have been. Bullied from time to time. I rode horses, so apparently that meant that I was gay, interestingly, although I had no idea whether I was or not at the time.
Hang on a minute. Riding horses means you're gay?
As we talked about this morning when we did the interview, it's nothing to do with your sexuality quite often. It's to do with whether you've got the right clothes, the right hair, live at the right side of town, or do the right sports. Mm-hmm. And I think that was... as we were growing up, it was mostly girls that rode. So it goes back to my point about gender.
It's the pony club thing.
Absolutely. Go back to the point about gender. But it didn't feel horrible. Yeah, that's the bizarre thing about it, because actually my life was so nice that having occasional times where people would shout, you suck horses off, actually didn't really bother me.
Talk about putting ideas in your head. This was small town sort of stuff then. If you were still down in the West Country, they're fairly small towns down there, aren't they?
Yeah, but
I mean, even Plymouth isn't a huge city.
No, it's not. But it was also the early 80s. Mm. So we were that people hadn't even realised that Kenneth Williams was gay, Julian Clary would just make smutty jokes. It was nothing to do with sexuality. Yeah. So I think it was just a particular point in time, and it wasn't recognised within the school. In the same way that lots of things went by unnoticed, bullying per se did, and racism, homophobia, sexism were all part of the mix.
Well, I think bullying was kind of regarded as normal part of life, wasn't it, in some respects? School bullying. I can remember my own father saying to me when I complained about being bullied, well, go back and bully back. You've got to learn to stand up for yourself. It's all part of growing up. It's all part of toughening up.
Yeah.
And I think that was pretty much the attitude that was around in those days.
It was. And I mean, interestingly, one of the things which I went on to do in my career was to run the Anti-Bullying Alliance. And we had bullying is not just another fact of life. Having come from sex education, sex is a fact of life. Bullying shouldn't be.
I was just interested, since you had what sounds like a pretty... pretty normal, average sort of childhood in many respects. You didn't have anything traumatic happen to you or anything like that. Whence comes your interest in championing young people? Because that's basically what you do, isn't it?
It is. There's a real pivotal moment which I can remember. Yeah, there are two or three things. And one is my primary school had a unit for children with Down syndrome and special needs. And I used to help. We all had to help, actually. It was a week on rota in terms of the playground. And then when it came to work experience, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to be helpful. So I went back to that unit, sort of 6 years later. And from that, I think that was when I really realised that we've got to make sure that all children, young people have the best opportunities that they can. So I volunteered in the summer to work with these children with Down syndrome, and I didn't have any idea what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to work with and for children and young people. And so I went along the route of psychology degree, still not knowing quite what I wanted to do, but it always had that sense. I believe in social justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to try and make that happen.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if we can dig up where that comes from. But in the meantime, I think it's time we took a little break. Your next piece of music, Ironic by Alana Morissette. What's this one about for you?
It actually is about the fact that life is ironic. And the danger is that sometimes we take things that go wrong too seriously. And my school teacher, Mrs. Howard, used to talk about bounce back ability. And I think if there's one thing that all of us need, it is that ability to bounce back. Your life isn't always as good as it should be. And as well as having a fantastic voice, I think this song sums that up.
Yes. Well, what in fancier terms I think we call resilience, isn't it?
These days. In the 80s,
we have a buzzword for it, as we used to. Okay, this is Ironic, Alanis Morissette. And this is Doug Pollard. And this hour, we're digging deeper with Simon Blake from the UK. He's the chief executive officer of Brook, the sexual health charity for young people over there. We were talking just now about how you got into your line of work, basically. And as we said off air, it's fairly clear you kind of sort of fell into it and then found it fitted you.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was at university, having made a decision that people and social justice was going to be part of my life, I worked in America on summer camp with young people.
Oh, you were one of these camp counsellors, were you?
I was indeed.
What the hell was that like? Because I've always imagined that to being an absolute nightmare.
There were times it was tough, actually. But overall, what a great opportunity and privilege to spend 6 weeks working with children outdoors all the time. So horse riding, lifeguarding, doing treks and camping. And what I really learnt from that was that young people often get short shrift, that we don't listen to them, we don't talk to them. In the same way with old people, actually. I could very happily do... And hopefully will at some point in the future work, around championing older people, that at both ends of the spectrum, we disregard what they've got to say. And so through that, I mean, the very first time that I got into sexual health was when I overheard a conversation when I was on night duty where these lads were talking about sex and they clearly had no idea and they were 15. And I went in and said, okay, shall we have a conversation about this? And as we did, I just thought, that's really shocking that adults have not spoken to lads. So at the age of 15, they don't know what it's about, how it happens, why it should happen, the responsibilities, the enjoyment, etc.
Well, again, I think we're talking, what sort of era are we talking about here?
That's 1992-93. So we're not talking about 100 years ago. We're talking about less than 20 years ago.
And this was in the US.
It's in the US. But all of the research shows that it's pretty similar in the UK and still.
How do they teach them how to abstain from something if they don't know what it is they're going to abstain from? Since they're so fond of abstinence education over there.
Well, luckily, in recent months, the funding for abstinence education is no longer there in the same way that it was. But this is the point, isn't it? If you go to our Northern European neighbours, where they're sensible about sex, young people have it when they can enjoy and take responsibility for it, not when they're drunk and because their mates were, which we often find.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking back to my early days in the UK, and you're probably right. Particularly North America and Britain, and I suspect to a certain extent Australia, although obviously I came to Australia fairly late in life, so I wasn't around when a lot of young people. There is still, I think, a considerable amount of kind of doubt and shame around sex, that there's still a lot of prudery and prurience around the whole sex ed business. We don't really handle it awfully well compared to our European neighbours.
That's absolutely true. And I'm here today having some conversations with the Foundation for Young Australians. And certainly the experience that they seem to have of young people is that is true, that we still don't talk about sex openly, confidently with young people. So they learn the sex, the shame, the embarrassment and the guilt that many of us learnt.
Why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think we are so uptight about it? Why does it take us until we reach a much greater age before we feel comfortable talking about it rather than sniggering about it, as we did as schoolboys?
Sure. Well, I think you behave in the way that you learn, don't you? So if the TV got turned off, or if you asked a question and you got told to stop being stupid, or nobody taught you about the fact somebody was divorcing in your family or gay in your family, what you learn is that relationships and sex are no-go areas. And it's, in places like Holland, they made deliberate public policy efforts to make sure that people talked about sex, people talked about relationships, because they recognised that that was related to pregnancy rates, to abortion rates, to rates of sexually transmitted infection, and but, relationship happiness.
Yeah, but I mean, the argument always is you mustn't teach the kids about sex too soon because you mustn't spoil their innocence, is one silly line we still hear a fair bit about. And the other one is that if you teach them about it too soon, they'll start having sex too soon.
Sure. It's a lovely theory, isn't it? That if we just talk to somebody about something, they will do it or they will become it. You know, so if we have a shortage of plumbers, we give them a leaflet on plumbing and they'll go out and be plumbers. You know, the reality is that we know that if you start early, talking to children early, and talk to them in the context of values and beliefs and about the fact that they need to be able to enjoy and take responsibility for it, they're much more likely to. If we stick our heads in the sand, then what you find is that young people are just, you know, any old sex ends up being okay. Whereas actually what we want to be saying to people is, you know, you need to think about this carefully.
All very different to what I grew up with, I must say, where it was very much sort of something you didn't talk about. I mean, you know, the very idea that people actually had sex was a very strange one. You know, I think I learned what little I did know about sex in my school days from my scout troop leader, and we won't go into that in any detail today. Okay, so this is sort of part of why you're passionate about what you do, isn't it? You're very much trying to change that culture.
Absolutely. I fundamentally believe that we do young people a disservice if we don't set them up to be able to negotiate and manage relationships, to consent to people touching them, not touching them, to borrowing things. You know, I just think that we've got to listen to children. We've got to help young people to take responsibility of their lives now and for the future. And that the only way we do that is by being honest, frank, and open about all issues.
Well, I think that's true about a lot of things, and not just sex, and not just for young people either. You know, I come from the north of England, so I'm fairly used to being straightforward about a lot of things, but sex wasn't one of them. As people around here will vouch, I got over it, though, in the end. Now, let's have another piece of music from you. A real gay icon here. You've got Pink, Mr. President.
Yeah, I think we're in a really interesting time with politics. I think we're asking different things of our elected representatives. We're asking them to engage in a dialogue with us. And Pink, I think, in this song, Dear Mr. President, says, you know, come walk with me, see life through my eyes. And I think that if we if we're really going to have the trust and faith in politicians that we need to, we have to find a way for that open dialogue. And as you say, big gay icon, the first time I've ever been in a room with as many lesbians cheering as it was when I went to the O2 to see Pink. And again, another one which just made me tingle all over.
Okay. And this is Doug Pollard, digging deeper with Simon Blake, the CEO of Brook UK. Now, we've kind of galloped ahead a little bit of ourselves because we're talking about your childhood, and now we've got talking about your work kind of thing. There's a bit of a gap in there up to a point. You're now running one of the, if not the biggest youth sexual health charity in the UK. That's a long way from talking to a few kids about sex ed as a camp counsellor in the US. Mm. So let's go back to where you started. You say you got into it around there. That was when you got interested in doing the sexual health thing. What was your first actual job dealing with sexual health issues?
It was with the Family Planning Association. I was working in America, as I said, and was travelling around a bit and increasingly relying on mum and dad to pay for my time in the States after I finished working. And when I went back to the UK, I had to get a job. So I worked in a bar. I did some work with Cardiff AIDS Helpline for a short period of time. But then I saw this job. I had absolutely no idea what it meant, but it was a project officer for Healthy Sexuality in the Community, a young men's project in the South Wales Valleys. I went for the interview, and I remember thinking, I did a pretty good job considering I don't really know what lots of these things actually are. And so when I was offered the job, they were clear there was a lot I needed to learn, but they thought they should invest in taking the chance of the young person who seemed to have his head screwed on the right way. And that job involved both training up volunteers, but also delivering sex education in the community, targeting boys and young men. It's one of the first projects to do that in the UK. So as well as doing that, there were also other people who wanted to know what on earth it was like running projects targeting boys and young men.
Well, what was it like? Because, I mean, you said to yourself just now that you didn't really know a lot about this when you got into it. You had to kind of learn on the job up to a point. What was it like the first time you went into a room full of these boys and started talking?
Well, luckily, they had trained me well in group work. So, you know, all of us know that sitting listening to some bloke at the front isn't going to work. But actually, you know, some training around group work. But what I very quickly realised was that the training I'd had before actually had only trained me to go into the room and learn. And what we found was that you had to be much more direct with the young men about what was going to be the learning outcome. It needed to be future orientated. There was no point trying to talk about feelings and, you know, what they'd learnt from the past. It needed to make sure that they didn't lose face in front of their mates. So you couldn't ever try and get somebody to talk in detail about something. So there's lots that was learnt, techniques used to make sure that they could feel safe, you know, talking about the fiction repeat whilst actually learning about what that might mean for them as well. Sometimes I was very good at it. Other times, you know, I really got it wrong and they would walk all over you, you know, and that was what was part of the
birth. Were you ever scared?
Well, there was one time where they took a dislike and I went out to find that my car mirrors had been broken and the tyre had been slashed. I was a bit scared then. But actually, in the moment, in the room, you know, I was pretty sure I could hold my own. So scared, no. Heart racing from time to time, yes, a bit.
Because it strikes me as, you know, this is very prickly territory for young men. That, as you say, they are very sensitive around this whole issue. It's really hard, you know, not to get their backs up. You do have to tread very carefully. But you've made a big thing in everything we've talked about up to now. You've made a very big thing about the listening rather than the talking. And it seems to me that sounds like your big strength.
Sure.
That you listen and take things in. You don't come to these things with too many preconceptions.
Well, I do believe that the best conversationist is the one who asks questions. You know, there are, if for some reason, we often think we have to know the answers. We often think that we have to be able to demonstrate that we're the most interesting. And actually, you know, what I learned very early on was that those people who are actually most interesting are the ones who are interested. And I think that's what the young men would come to say about me, actually. You know, when we had some leaving do's and some rituals around it.
I wish I'd met some men like you when I was dating. All they seem to do is just talk to me.
Well, they get quite boring then, don't they?
They do.
Yeah,
they do. And I can be equally as boring as anyone around here will attest.
But it also becomes a real pressure on yourself when you think you've got to be interesting all the time. Whereas you're actually learning to ask the next question.
But it does take a great deal of confidence not to do that. I think in some respects it takes more confidence to listen than it does to talk. Because you have to you have to let yourself go into the moment, as it were, and accept what's coming.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And one of the things which, you know, my members of staff in my team will say that I'm very good at is listening, understanding and summarising in the moment. The downside of that, of course, is that sometimes you say things in the moment that with a bit more reflection, you probably wouldn't have said.
Yes, you might not have said.
But we all have our crosses to bear. And I think that sort of sense of really being in the moment. I think that links back to what I was saying about the Alanis Morissette song, you know, mm-hmm. is that sometimes we worry too much about the 3 weeks ago, 6 weeks ahead, whereas actually if we just live in the moment, nothing is really that bad that we can't manage it.
Yeah, unfortunately in the West we're not really taught to live in the moment, are we? We're always supposed to be planning for our retirement from the moment we leave school, if you listen to the adverts. you know, what is your career path and so on and so forth. You know, I never had one. It didn't do me any harm, as they say. It seems like, in a sense, you didn't. You, as you say, fell into this and then found your way from there. So you started out with this project in South Wales. Obviously, you really found your feet in this arena. Mm. You've also written a number of books about and for young people, am I right in saying, to do with sex and sexuality and so on. What prompted you to decide to go into print?
I think one of the things that I'm very clear about is that if you choose to go into what I would call public service work, you have a responsibility to try and make sure that the public money is spent as well as it can be. And therefore, you know, I learned an awful lot in those early days in the South Wales Valleys, working with boys and young men. And there were other projects which were popping up around the country. And I felt so I had a responsibility to write down what I'd learned so that people had a head start. You know, it took me 6 months to a year to get some of the basics. So it seemed pointless that other people would have that.
So to stop people having to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah, exactly. But also I realised later that I learn best when I write as well. So an experience for me can often be processed because you've got to work it out. If you're going to tell somebody something, it's got to be clear and it's got to make sense.
I've often heard other people say, I didn't really know what I thought about this until I started writing it down.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, it forces you to order your thoughts. Speaking as a journalist who works in print as well as on radio, I know what that feels like.
Yeah.
That, you know, you don't know what your attitude is and you actually don't even know what you've learned a lot of the time until somebody asks you.
I think that's absolutely right. And you know, one of the vital bits of learning, you know, is, well, what did you learn today? You know, and that's, you know, when you are with young people, you know, with children or even as an adult, and somebody says, what did you learn today? If you're not asked that question, then often you don't really know. And I think writing was one of those things, but it was really about when you're doing work which has significance for other people, then I feel as though you have a responsibility to disseminate that learning.
Yeah. Well, I particularly want to talk to you about your book called Young Gay Men Talking, because I want to, you know, relate that to the gay audience that obviously we serve with this radio station, because we're a gay and lesbian radio station. But before we do that, more music. Empire State of Mind, Alicia Keys.
Yeah, I think this links really to what you're saying about just falling into something. One of the things which I always knew was that I wanted to do something, and actually it almost didn't matter quite what it was. And I think that sense of being able to do something was always instilled in me from a very early age. And Empire State of Mind talks about dreams. And I think, you know, many of us need to imagine, need to dream and allow ourselves to go with that. And that, for me, is what this is about. Plus, it's just a good song.
Okay, Alicia Keys, Empire State of Mind. Well, we're coming to the end of our interview with Simon Blake from Brook in the UK, the sexual health charity for young people. We were talking just before that piece of music from Alicia Keys about the fact that you went into print and that you wrote books, basically so that other people would not have to go over the same ground to get where you got to. They could, like, stand on your shoulders in a sense, I suppose. One of the books she wrote was called Young Gay Men Talking. Now, I was interested to know what's that about?
There's an organisation,
apart from the obvious.
There's an organisation called Working With Men in the UK who did a series which is called Young Men Talking. Mm-hmm. And they took a number of different groups of young men. So there were young men in Belfast around the Troubles, mm-hmm. you know, the conflict, young fathers, and Young Gay Men Talking was one which I was asked to do. I think one of the most important things we can do is to give people a voice, and particularly if a group hasn't had a voice in public policy debates, in the public, in the media. And so Young Gay Men Talking was basically what it says on the tin. I went and talked to young gay men. And then
more of you listening
summarized what I thought they told me. And one of the things that was really striking when I looked at what they told me, which was, sometimes we've got to accept that being gay doesn't come with all sorts of problems, and with the right circumstances, that grow up as gay and happy. But that there are also particular things: bullying, mental health, eating disorders, say unsafe sex, predatory sexual relationships, which felt as though different professionals needed to answer. So I wrote it all up, direct quotes, and took it to a group of professionals across different disciplines and asked them to respond to what they heard, and wrote an essay about what they thought particular groups should do. And what I think came out of that was really an opportunity for people to reflect on young gay men's experience, what they told us, and then to think what they could do to make sure that in their area of work, they did all they could to make sure that the bad things didn't happen again and the good things were worked on to really help their emotional and social development. We used it to lobby around Department of Health, Department of Children, Schools and Families work, and to take into different youth work, sexual health services.
Because one question that keeps getting thrown at me by different people, particularly straight friends of mine, is, why do you gays keep banging on about being gay? Why do you have to keep telling us? We don't keep telling you we're straight. And I keep throwing back at them the fact that if we don't keep reminding people that not everybody is straight, everyone assumes we all are, and we get left out of things. So the fact that you could take a book like that to government, to or these various bodies, and to use it as, evidence of our existence, even is a very valuable thing to have done. I think in the UK probably we're a lot more visible than we are in Australia. I think we don't get forgotten quite as much over there, thanks to the changes in the law.
I think that is possibly true, and I guess what we really have to focus on is the individual experience. And I think one of the things, we had a campaign in the UK, which was, my son's a homophobe, I hope it's just a phase. I don't mind straights as long as they don't flaunt it. All those things.
Yeah.
And of course, what you're actually doing is asking people to think something different about what they've grown up thinking. It's big culture change. But even so, we still don't see people walking down the street holding hands, kissing, in public spaces. Mm. You don't see the Prime Minister with a same-sex partner on stage. Yeah, there are all those sorts of things. And so I hope that when your friends are asking you those questions, they don't really mean it. But I also think there is a point. Sometimes it doesn't need to be said anymore. You're in a company which accepts it. And we have to be mindful all the time, don't you, of winning support for people who aren't gay to champion the cause of gay people.
Yeah, because that's the important point, isn't it? As a minority, you would never get anywhere without allies. Yeah. And those alliances are very important to build. Well, Simon, we could talk for hours because of your experience and your life and everything else, but we're running out of time here. I want to thank you very much for taking an hour out of your day today to talk to me, because you're only here for a few days. And we hope we'll see some more of you in Oz in the future. And if you want to keep track of us, of course, you can always listen to this show online. We do stream. We hope you will. And if you also want to hear a little more of yourself, we will be podcasting this hour as well. It'll be available for download. So there you are. Well, Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was my special guest today, Simon Blake from the Brook. I want to call it the Brook Institute, or the Brook something, rather than just Brook. It's a very abrupt name, isn't it? Before you go, however, we have one last piece of music. Prefab Sprout, King of Rock and Roll. What's this one?
I got asked to have these five songs last night. I had just landed in Melbourne. I was really tired, and I was trying to think through different phases of my life. And this is just the summer that I left home. I was free. It was funky. It was a song which signifies to me that feeling of being 16 and about to catapult into whoever, who knew where, but look, the base of where I am now.
Okay. Simon, thank you very much for your time today.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.